friend discovered Mrs. Richard Forbes during the hurricane last night." Salander nodded. "Where did you find her?"
"On the beach, just below the gate," Salander said. "We almost tripped over her."
Ferguson wrote that down. "Did she say anything?" Salander shook her head. "She was unconscious?" Salander nodded sensibly. "She had a nasty wound on her head." Salander nodded again. "You don't know how she was injured." Salander shook her head. Ferguson muttered in irritation at her lack of response.
"There was a lot of stuff flying through the air," she said helpfully. "I was almost hit in the head by a plank."
"You injured your leg?" Ferguson pointed at her bandage. "What happened?"
"I didn't notice it until I got down to the cellar."
"You were with a young man?"
"George Bland."
"Where does he live?"
"In a shack behind the coconut, on the road to the airport. If the shack is still standing, that is."
Salander did not add that Bland was at that moment asleep in her bed 3 floors above them. "Did either of you see her husband, Richard Forbes?" Salander shook her head. Constable Ferguson could not, it seemed, think of any other questions to ask, and he closed his notebook. "Thank you, Miss Salander. I'll have to write up a report on the death."
"Did she die?"
"Mrs. Forbes? No, she's in hospital in St. George's. Apparently she has you and your friend to thank for the fact that she's alive. But her husband is dead. His body was found in a parking lot at the airport 2 hours ago."
600 yards further south.
"He was pretty badly knocked about," Ferguson said.
"How unfortunate,"
Salander said, without any great sign of shock. When McBain and Constable Ferguson had gone, Ella came and sat at Salander's table. She set down 2 shot glasses of rum. Salander gave her a quizzical look.
"After a night like that, you need something to rebuild your strength. I'm buying. I'm buying the whole breakfast."
The two women looked at each other. Then they clinked glasses and said, "Cheers." For a long time to come, Matilda would be the object of scientific studies and discussions at meteorological institutes in the Caribbean and across the United States. Tornadoes of Matilda's scale were almost unknown in the region. Gradually, the experts agreed that a particularly rare constellation of weather fronts had combined to create a pseudo-tornado, something that was not actually a tornado, but looked like one. Salander did not care about the theoretical discussion. She knew what she had seen, and she decided to try to avoid getting in the way of any of Matilda's siblings in the future. Many people on the island had been injured during the night. Only one person died. No one would ever know what had induced Richard Forbes to go out in the midst of a full-fledged hurricane, save possibly that sheer ignorance which seemed common to American tourists. Geraldine Forbes was not able to offer any explanation. She had suffered a severe concussion and had only incoherent memories of the events of that night. On the other hand, she was inconsolable to have been left a widow. Part 2. From Russia with Love, January 10th to March 23rd. An equation commonly contains one or more so-called unknowns, often represented by X, Y, Z, etc., values given to the unknowns which yield equality between both sides of the equation are said to satisfy the equation and constitute a solution. Example, 3x plus 4 equals 6x minus 2. X equals 2. Chapter 4. Monday, January 10th to Tuesday, January 11th. Salander landed at Stockholm's Arlanda Airport at noon. In addition to the flying time, she had spent 9 hours at Grantley Adams Airport on Barbados. British Airways had refused to let the aircraft take off until a passenger who looked vaguely Arabic had been taken away for questioning and a possible terrorist threat had been snuffed out. By the time she landed at Gatwick in London, she had missed her connecting flight to Sweden and had had to wait overnight before she could be rebooked. Salander felt like a bag of bananas that had been left too long in the sun. All she had with her was a carry-on bag containing her power book, dimensions, and a change of clothes.
She passed unchecked through the green gate at customs. When she got outside to the airport shuttle buses, she was welcomed home by a blast of freezing sleet. She hesitated. All her life she had had to choose the cheapest option, and she was not yet used to the idea that she had more than 3 billion kroner, which she had stolen by means of an internet coup combined with good old-fashioned fraud. After a few moments of getting cold and wet, she said to hell with the rule-book and waved for a taxi. She gave the driver her address on Lundegarten and fell asleep in the back seat. It was not until the taxi drew up on Lundegarten and the driver shook her awake that she realized she had given him her old address. She told him she had changed her mind, and asked him to continue on to Gutgutsparken. She gave him a big tip in dollars, and swore as she stepped into a puddle in the gutter. She was dressed in jeans, T-shirt, and a thin cloth jacket. She wore sandals and short cotton socks. She walked gingerly over to the 7-Eleven, where she bought some shampoo, toothpaste, soap, kefir, milk, cheese, eggs, bread, frozen cinnamon rolls, coffee, Lipton's tea bags, a jar of pickles, apples, a large package of Billy's pan pizza, and a pack of Marlboro Lights. She paid with a Visa card. When she came back out on the street, she hesitated about which way to go. She could walk up Svartensgatan or down Hökensgata towards Slussen. The drawback with Hökensgata was that she would have to walk right past the door of the Millennium offices, running the risk of bumping into Blomqvist. In the end, she decided not to go out of her way to avoid him. She walked towards Slussen, although it was a bit longer that way, and turned off to the right by way of Hökensgata up to Mosebacher Torg. She cut across the square past the statue of the sisters in front of Södra Theatre, and took the steps up the hill to Fiskargarten. She stopped and looked up at the apartment building pensively. It did not really feel like home. She looked around. It was an out-of-the-way spot in the middle of Södermalm Island. There was no through traffic, which was fine with her. It was easy to observe who was moving about the area. It was apparently popular with walkers in the summertime, but in the winter the only ones there were those who had business in the neighbourhood. There was hardly a soul to be seen now, certainly not anyone she recognised, or who might reasonably be expected to recognise her. Sarinda set down her shopping bag in the slush to dig out her keys. She took the elevator to the top floor and unlocked the door with the nameplate V. Kulla. One of the first things Sarinder had done after she came into a very large sum of money and thereby became financially independent for the rest of her life, or for as long as 3 billion kroner could be expected to last, was to look around for an apartment. The property market had been a new experience for her. She had never before invested money in anything more substantial than occasional, useful items which she could either pay for with cash or buy on a reasonable payment plan. The biggest outlays had previously been various computers and her lightweight Kawasaki motorcycle. She had bought the bike for 7,000 kroner, a real bargain. She had spent about as much on spare parts and devoted several months to taking the motorcycle apart and overhauling it. She had wanted a car, but she had been wary of buying one since she did not know how she would have fit it into her budget. Buying an apartment, she realized, was a deal of a different order. She had started by reading the classified ads in the online editions of Dagens Nyheter, which was a science all to itself, she discovered. One bedroom, plus living/dining, fantastic lock, near Södra Station, 2.7 million kroner or highest bid, S/CH5510P/M. 3 rooms plus kitchen, Parkview, Högalid, 2.9 million kroner. 2 rooms, 47 square meters, renovated bath, new plumbing, 1998, Götlandsgard, 1.8 million kroner, S/CH2200P/M. She had telephoned some of the numbers haphazardly, but she had no idea what questions to ask. Soon she felt so idiotic that she stopped even trying. Instead, she went out on the first Sunday in January and visited 2 apartment open houses. One was on Vindragavegen, way out on Reimersholm, and the other on Heleneborgsgarten, near Hornstuhl. The apartment on Reimers was a bright four-room place in a tower block with a view of Longholmen and Essingen. There she could be content. The apartment on Heleneborgsgarten was a dump, with a view of the building next door. The problem was that she could not decide which part of town she wanted to live in, how her apartment should look, or what sort of questions she should be asking of her new home. She had never thought about an alternative to the 500 square feet on Lundegarten, where she had spent her childhood. Through her trustee at the time, the lawyer, Holger Palmgren, she had been granted possession of the apartment when she turned 18. She plopped down on the lumpy sofa in her combination office living room and began to think. The apartment on Lundegarten looked into a courtyard. It was cramped and not the least bit comfortable. The view from her bedroom was a firewall on a gable facade. The view from the kitchen was of the back of the building facing the street and the entrance to the basement storage area. She could see a street light from her living room and a few branches of a birch tree. The first requirement of her new home was that it should have some sort of view. She did not have a balcony and had always envied well-to-do neighbours higher up in the building who spent warm days with a cold beer under an awning on theirs. The second requirement was that her new home would have to have a balcony. What should the apartment look like? She thought about Blomqvist's apartment, 700 square feet in one open space in a converted loft on Bellmansgarten, with views of City Hall and the locks at Slussen. She had liked it there. She wanted to have a pleasant, sparsely furnished apartment that was easy to take care of. That was a third point on her list of requirements. For years she had lived in cramped spaces. Her kitchen was a mere 100 square feet, with room for only a tiny table and two chairs. Her living room was 200 square feet. The bedroom was 120. Her fourth requirement was that the new apartment should have plenty of space and closets. She wanted to have a proper office and a big bedroom where she could spread herself out. Her bathroom was a windowless cubbyhole with square cement slabs on the floor, an awkward half-bath, and plastic wallpaper that never got really clean no matter how hard she scrubbed it. She wanted to have tiles and a big bath. She wanted a washing machine in the apartment and not down in some basement. She wanted the bathroom to smell fresh, and she wanted to be able to open a window. Then she studied the offerings of estate agents online. The next morning she got up early to visit Nobel Estates, the company that, according to some, had the best reputation in Stockholm. She was dressed in old black jeans, boots, and her black leather jacket. She stood at a counter and watched a blonde woman of about 35 who had just logged on to the Nobel Estates website and was uploading photographs of apartments. At length, a short, plump, middle-aged man with thin red hair came over. She asked him what sort of apartments he had available. He looked up at her in surprise and then assumed an avuncular tone. "Well, young lady, do your parents know that you're thinking of moving away from home?" Salander gave him a stone-cold glare until he stopped chuckling. "I want an apartment," she said. He cleared his throat and glanced appealingly at his colleague on the computer.
"I see. And what kind of apartment did you have in mind?"
"I think I'd like an apartment in Söder, with a balcony and a view of the water, at least four rooms, a bathroom with a window, and a utility room. And there has to be a lockable area where I can keep a motorcycle."
The woman at the computer looked up and stared at Salander.
"A motorcycle?" the thin-haired man said.
Salander nodded.
"May I know your name?"
Salander told him. She asked him for his name, and he introduced himself as Joachim Persson.
"The thing is, it's rather expensive to purchase a cooperative apartment here in Stockholm."
Salander did not reply. She had asked him what sort of apartments he had to offer. The information that it cost money was irrelevant.
"What line of work are you in?"
Salander thought for a moment. Technically, she was a freelancer. In practice, she worked only for Armansky and Milton Security, but that had been somewhat irregular over the past year. She had not done any work for him in 3 months.
"I'm not working at anything at the moment," she said.
"Well, then, I presume you're still at school."
"No, I'm not at school."
Persson came around the counter and put his arm kindly around Salander's shoulders, escorting her towards the door.
"Well, you see, Miss Salander, we'd be happy to welcome you back in a few years' time, but you'd have to bring along a little more money than what's in your piggy bank. The fact is that a weekly allowance won't really cover this."
He pinched her good-naturedly on the cheek.
"So drop in again, and we'll see about finding you a little pad."
Sarinda stood on the street outside Nobel Estates for several minutes. She wondered, absent-mindedly, what little Master Persson would think if a Molotov cocktail came flying through his display window. Then she went home and booted up her power book. It took her 10 minutes to hack into Nobel Estate's internal computer network using the passwords she happened to notice the woman behind the counter type in before she started uploading photographs. It took 3 minutes to find out that the computer the woman was working on was in fact also the company's net server.
How dim can you get?
And another 3 minutes to gain access to all 14 computers on the network. After about 2 hours, she had gone through Persson's records and discovered that there were some 750,000 kroner in under-the-table income that he had not reported to the tax authorities over the past 2 years. She downloaded all the necessary files and emailed them to the tax authorities from an anonymous email account on a server in the USA. Then she put Master Persson out of her mind. She spent the rest of the day going through Nobel Estate's listed properties. The most expensive one was a small palace outside Mariefred, where she had no desire to live. Out of sheer perversity, she chose the next most expensive, a huge apartment just off Mosebacher Torg. She scrutinized the photographs and floor plan, and in the end decided that it more than fulfilled her requirements. It had previously been owned by a director of the Assea Brown Bovary Power Company, who slipped into obscurity after he got himself a much-discussed and much-criticized golden parachute of several billion kroner. That evening she telephoned Jeremy Macmillan, partner in the law firm Macmillan and Marks in Gibraltar. She had done business with Macmillan before. For a fee even he thought generous, he had set up P.O. Box companies to be owners of the accounts that administered the fortune she had stolen a year ago from the corrupt financier Hans-Erik Wennerström. She engaged Macmillan's services again, instructing him to open negotiations with Nobel Estates on behalf of Wasp Enterprises to buy the apartment on Fiskargarten near Mosebacher Torg. It took 4 days, and the figure finally arrived at made her raise her eyebrows, plus the 5% commission to Macmillan. Before the week was out, she had moved in with 2 boxes of clothes and bed linens, a mattress, and some kitchen utensils. She slept on the mattress in the apartment for 3 weeks while she investigated clinics for plastic surgery, straightened out a number of unresolved bureaucratic details, including a nighttime talk with a certain lawyer, Niels Bjørman, and paid in advance for the rent at her old place, as well as the electricity bills and other monthly expenses. Then she had booked her journey to the clinic in Italy. When the treatments were done and she was discharged, she sat in a hotel room in Rome and thought about what to do next. She should have returned to Sweden to get on with her life, but for various reasons she could not bear to think about Stockholm. She had no real profession. She could see for herself no future at Milton Security. It was not Armansky's fault. In all probability he would have liked her to work full-time and turn herself into an efficient cog in the company machine, but at the age of 25 she lacked the education, and she had no wish to find herself pushing 50 and still plodding away doing investigations of crooks in the corporate world. It was an amusing hobby, not a lifetime career. Another reason she was reluctant to return to Stockholm was Blomqvist. In Stockholm she would risk running into Kalle fucking Blomqvist, and at the moment that was just about the last thing she wanted to do. He had hurt her. She acknowledged that this had not been his intention. He had behaved rather decently. It was her own fault that she had fallen in love with him. The very phrase was a contradiction when it came to Lisbeth fucking bitch Sallander. Blomqvist was known for being a ladies' man. At best, she had been an amusing diversion, someone on whom he had taken pity at a moment when he needed her, and there was no one better available. But he had quickly moved on to yet more amusing company. She cursed herself for lowering her guard and letting him into her life. When she came to her senses again, she cut off all contact with him. It had not been easy, but she had steeled herself. The last time she saw him, she was standing on a platform in the Tunnelbana at Gamla Stan, and he was sitting in the train on his way downtown. She had stared at him for a whole minute, and decided that she did not have a grain of feeling left, because it would have been the same as bleeding to death.
Fuck you.
He had noticed her just as the doors closed, and looked at her with searching eyes before she turned and walked away, as the train pulled out. She didn't understand why he had so stubbornly tried to stay in contact with her, as if she were some fucking welfare project he had taken on. It annoyed her that he was so clueless. Every time he sent her an email, she had to force herself to delete the message without reading it. Stockholm did not seem in the least attractive. Apart from the freelance work for Milton Security, a few discarded bed partners and the girls in the old rock group Evil Fingers, she hardly knew anyone in her hometown. The only person she had any respect for now was Armansky. It was not easy to define her feelings for him. She had always felt a mild surprise that she was attracted to him. If he had not been quite so married, or quite so old, or quite so conservative, she might have considered making an advance. So she took out her diary and turned to the Atlas section. She had never been to Australia, or Africa. She had read about but never seen the pyramids, or Angkor Wat. She had never ridden on the Star Ferry between Kowloon and Victoria in Hong Kong, and she had never gone snorkeling in the Caribbean or sat on a beach in Thailand. Apart from some quick business trips when she had visited the Baltics and neighbouring Nordic countries, as well as Zurich and London, of course, she had hardly ever left Sweden. As a matter of fact, she had seldom been outside Stockholm. In the past, she could never afford it. She stood at the window of her hotel room, overlooking Via Garibaldi in Rome. The city was like a pile of ruins. Then she made up her mind. She put on her jacket and went down to the lobby and asked if there was a travel agent in the vicinity. She booked a one-way ticket to Tel Aviv, and spent the following days walking through the old city in Jerusalem, and visiting the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Wailing Wall. She viewed the armed soldiers on street corners with distrust, and then she flew to Bangkok, and kept on travelling for the rest of the year. There was only one thing she really had to do. She went to Gibraltar twice, the first time to do an in-depth investigation of the man she had chosen to look after her money, the second time to see to it that he was doing it properly. It felt quite odd to turn the key to her own apartment on Fiskargatan after such a long time. She set down her groceries and her shoulder bag in the hall and tapped in the 4-digit code that turned off the electronic burglar alarm. Then she stripped off her damp clothes and dropped them on the hall floor. She walked into the kitchen naked, plugged in the refrigerator, and put the food away before she headed for the bathroom and spent the next 10 minutes in the shower. She ate a meal consisting of a Billy's pan pizza, which she heated in the microwave, and a sliced apple. She opened one of her moving boxes and found a pillow, some sheets, and a blanket that smelled a little suspect, after having been packed away for a year. She made up her bed on the mattress in a room next to the kitchen. She fell asleep within 10 seconds of her head hitting the pillow, and slept for almost 12 hours. Then she got up, turned on the coffee maker, wrapped a blanket around herself and sat in the dark on a window seat, smoking a cigarette and looking out towards Djurgården and Solsjön, fascinated by the lights. The day after Salander came home was a full day. She locked the door of her apartment at 7 in the morning. Before she left her floor, she opened a ventilation window in the stairwell and fastened a spare key to a thin copper wire that she had tied to the wall side of a drainpipe clamp. Experience had taught her the wisdom of always having a spare key readily accessible. The air outside was icy. Salander was dressed in a pair of thin, worn jeans that had a rip beneath one back pocket where her blue panties showed through. She had on a T-shirt and a warm polo sweater with a seam that had started to fray at the neck. She had also rediscovered her scuffed leather jacket with the rivets on the shoulders and decided she should ask a tailor to repair the almost non-existent lining in the pockets. She was wearing heavy socks and boots. Overall, she was nice and warm. She walked down St. Paul's Garden to Zinkensdamm and over to her old apartment on Lundegarten. She checked first of all that her Kawasaki was still safe in the basement. She patted the seat before she went up to the apartment and had to push the front door open against a mountain of junk mail. She hadn't been sure what to do with the apartment, so when she'd left Sweden a year ago, the simplest solution had been to arrange an automatic bank account to pay her regular bills. She still had furniture in the apartment, laboriously collected over time from various trash containers, along with some chipped mugs, 2 older computers, and a lot of paper. But nothing of value. She took a black trash bag from the kitchen and spent 5 minutes sorting the junk from the real mail. Most of the heap went straight into the plastic bag. There were a few letters for her, mainly bank statements and tax forms from Milton Security. One advantage of being under guardianship was that she never had to deal with tax matters. Communications of that sort were conspicuous by their absence. Otherwise, in a whole year, she had accumulated only 3 personal letters. The first was from a lawyer, Greta Molander, who had served as executor for Salander's mother. The letter stated that her mother's estate had been settled, and that Lisbeth Salander and her sister Camilla had inherited 9,312 kroner each. A deposit of said amount had been made to Miss Salander's bank account, would she please confirm receipt? Salander stuffed the letter in the inside pocket of her jacket. The second was from Director Mikkelsen of Eppelviken Nursing Home, a friendly reminder that they were storing a box of her mother's personal effects. Would she please contact Eppelviken with instructions as to what she would like done with these items? The letter ended with the warning that if they did not hear from Salander or her sister, for whom they had no address, before the end of the year, they would have no alternative, space being at a premium, but to discard the items. She saw that the letter was dated June, and she took out her mobile telephone. The box was still there. She apologized for not responding sooner, and promised to pick it up the next day. The last letter was from Blomqvist. She thought for a moment, before deciding not to open it, and threw it into the bag. She filled another box with various items and knick-knacks that she wanted to keep, then took a taxi back to Mosebacher. She put on makeup, a pair of glasses, and a blonde shoulder-length wig, and tucked a Norwegian passport in the name of Irene Nessa into her bag. She studied herself in the mirror and decided that Irene Nessa looked a little bit like Lisbeth Salander, but was still a completely different person. After a quick lunch of a brie baguette and a latte at Café Eden on Goethegarten, she walked down to the car rental agency on Ringvägen, where Irene Nessa rented a Nissan Micra. She drove to IKEA at Kungens Kurve and spent 3 hours browsing through the merchandise, writing down the item numbers she needed. She made a few quick decisions. She bought 2 Carlander sofas with sand-coloured upholstery, 5 Boeing armchairs, 2 round side tables of clear lacquered birch, a Svansburg coffee table, and several lac occasional tables. From the storage department she ordered 2 Ivar combination storage units and 2 Bonde bookshelves, a TV stand, and a Magica unit with doors. She settled on a Pax Nexus 3-door wardrobe and 2 small Malm bureaus. She spent a long time selecting a bed and decided on a Hemnes bed frame with mattress and bedside tables. To be on the safe side, she also bought a Lillehammer bed to put in the spare room. She didn't plan on having any guests, but since she had a guest room, she might as well furnish it. The bathroom in her new apartment was already equipped with a medicine cabinet, towel storage, and a washing machine the previous owners had left behind. All she had to buy was a cheap laundry basket. What she did need, though, was kitchen furniture. After some thought, she decided on a Rosfors kitchen table of solid beechwood with a tabletop of tempered glass and 4 colourful kitchen chairs. She also needed furniture for her office. She looked at some improbable work stations with ingenious cabinets for storing computers and keyboards. In the end, she shook her head and ordered an ordinary desk, the Gallant, in beech veneer with an angled top and rounded corners, and a large filing cabinet. She took a long time choosing an office chair, in which she would no doubt spend many hours, and chose one of the most expensive options, the Werksam. She made her way through the entire warehouse and bought a good supply of sheets, pillowcases, hand towels, duvets, blankets, pillows, a starter pack of stainless steel cutlery, some crockery, pots and pans, cutting boards, 3 big rugs, several work lamps, and a huge quantity of office supplies, folders, file boxes, waste paper baskets, storage boxes, and the like. She paid with a card in the name of Wasp Enterprises and showed her Irene Nessa ID. She also paid to have the items delivered and assembled. The bill came to a little over 90,000 kroner. She was back in Sudder by 5 p.m., and had time for a quick visit to Axelsson's Home Electronics, where she bought a 19-inch TV and a radio. Just before closing time, she slipped into a store on Hornsgarten and bought a vacuum cleaner. At Marihallen Market, she bought a mop, dishwashing liquid, a bucket, some detergent, hand soap, toothbrushes, and a giant package of toilet paper. She was tired but pleased after her shopping frenzy. She stowed all her purchases in her rented Nissan Micra and then collapsed in Café Java on Hornsgarten. She borrowed an evening paper from the next table and learned that the Social Democrats were still the ruling party, and that nothing of great significance seemed to have occurred in Sweden while she had been away. She was home by 8. Under cover of darkness, she unloaded her car and carried the items up to V. Kuller's apartment. She left everything in a big pile in the hall and spent half an hour trying to find somewhere to park. Then she ran water in the jacuzzi, which was easily big enough for 3 people. She thought about Blomqvist for a moment. Until she saw the letter from him that morning, she had not thought about him for several months. She wondered whether he was home, and whether the Berger woman was there now in his apartment. After a while she took a deep breath, turned over on her stomach, and sank beneath the surface of the water. She put her hands on her breasts, and pinched her nipples hard, holding her breath for far too long, until her lungs began to ache. Erika Berger, editor-in-chief, checked her clock when Blomqvist arrived. He was almost 15 minutes late for the planning meeting that was held on the second Tuesday of each month at 10 a.m. sharp. Tentative plans for the next issue were outlined, and decisions about the content of the magazine were made for several months in advance. Blomqvist apologized for his late arrival and muttered an explanation that nobody heard, or at least bothered to acknowledge. Apart from Berger, the meeting included managing editor Malin Eriksson, partner and art director Krista Malm, the reporter Monica Nielsen, and part-timers Lotta Karim and Henry Cortez. Blomqvist saw at once that the intern was absent, but that the group had been augmented by a new face at the small conference table in Berger's office. It was very unusual for her to let an outsider in on Millennium's planning sessions.
"This is Dag Svensson," said Erika, "freelancer. We're going to buy an article from him."
Blomqvist shook hands with the man. Svensson was blonde and blue-eyed, with a crew cut and a 3-day growth of beard. He was around 30 and looked shamelessly fit.
"We usually run 1 or 2 themed issues each year,"
Berger went on where she had left off.
"I want to use this story in the May issue. The printer is booked for April 27th. That gives us a good 3 months to produce the articles."
"So what's the theme?" Blomqvist wondered aloud as he poured coffee from the thermos.
"Dag came to me last week with the outline for a story. That's why I asked him to join us today. Will you take it from here, Dag?"
Berger said.
"Trafficking," Svensson said. "That is the sex trade. In this case, primarily of girls from the Baltic countries and Eastern Europe. If you'll allow me to start at the beginning, I'm writing a book on the subject, and that's why I contacted Millennium. Since you now have a book publishing operation."
Everyone looked amused. Millennium Publishing had so far issued exactly 1 book, Blomqvist's year-old brick about the billionaire Wennerström's financial empire. The book was in its 6th printing in Sweden, had been published in Norwegian, German, and English, and was soon to be translated into French, too. The sales success was remarkable, given that the story was by now so well known and had been reported in every newspaper.
"Our book publishing ventures are not very extensive," Blomqvist said cautiously.
Even Svensson gave a slight smile.
"I understand that. But you do have the means to publish a book." "There are plenty of larger companies," Blomqvist said. "Well-established ones."
"Without a doubt," Berger said. "But for a year now we've been discussing the possibility of starting a niche publication list in addition to our regular activities. We've brought it up at 2 board meetings, and everyone has been positive. We're thinking of a very small list, 3 or 4 books a year, of reportage on various topics. Typical journalistic publications, in other words. This would be a good book to start with."
"Trafficking," Blomqvist said. "Tell us about it." "I've been digging around in the subject of trafficking for 4 years now. I got into the topic through my girlfriend. Her name is Mia Johansson, and she's a criminologist and gender studies scholar. She previously worked at the Crime Prevention Centre and wrote a report on the sex trade." "I've met her," Eriksson said suddenly. "I did an interview with her 2 years ago when she published a report comparing the way men and women were treated by the courts."
Svensson smiled.
"That did create a stir.
but she's been researching trafficking for 5 or 6 years. That's how we met. I was working on a story about the sex trade on the internet and got a tip that she knew something about it. And she did. To make a long story short, she and I began working together, I as a journalist and she as a researcher. In the process, we started dating, and a year ago we moved in together. She's working on her doctorate, and she'll be defending her dissertation this year. So she's writing a doctoral thesis, while you... I'm writing a popular version of her dissertation and adding my own research, as well as a shorter version in the form of the article that I outlined for Erica. Oh, you're working as a team. What's the story? We have a government that introduced a tough sex trade law. We have police who are supposed to see to it that the law is obeyed. And we have courts that are supposed to convict sex criminals. We call the Johns sex criminals, since it has become a crime to buy sexual services. And we have the media, which write indignant articles about the subject, etc. At the same time, Sweden is one of the countries that imports the most prostitutes per capita from Russia and the Baltics. And you can substantiate this? It's no secret. It's not even news. What's new is that we have met and talked with a dozen girls, most of them are 15 to 20 years old. They come from social misery in Eastern Europe and are lured to Sweden with a promise of some kind of job but end up in the clutches of an unscrupulous sex mafia. Those girls have experienced things that you couldn't even show in a movie. Okay? It's the focus of Mia's dissertation, so to speak, but not of the book. Everyone was listening intently. Mia interviewed the girls. What I did was to chart the suppliers and the client base. Blomqvist smiled. He had never met Svensson before, but he felt at once that Svensson was the kind of journalist he liked, someone who got right to the heart of the story. For Blomqvist, the golden rule of journalism was that there were always people who were responsible. The bad guys. And you found some interesting facts? I can document, for instance, that a civil servant in the Ministry of Justice, who was involved in the drafting of the sex trade law, has exploited at least 2 girls who came to Sweden through the agency of the sex mafia. One of them was 15. Whoa! I've been working on this story off and on for 3 years. The book will contain case studies of the Johns. There are 3 policemen, one of whom works for the security police, another on the vice squad. There are 5 lawyers, 1 prosecutor and 1 judge. There are also 3 journalists, one of whom has written articles on the sex trade. In his private life, he's into rape fantasies with a teenage whore from Tallinn. And in this case, it's not consensual sex play. I'm thinking of naming names. I've got watertight documentation. Blomqvist whistled. Since I've become a publisher again, I want to go over the documentation with a fine-tooth comb, he said. The last time I was sloppy about checking sources, I ended up spending 2 months in prison. If you want to publish the story, I can give you all the documentation you want. But I have 1 condition for selling the story to Millennium.
Dag wants us to publish the book, too, Berger said.
Precisely. I want it to be dropped like a bomb, and right now Millennium is the most credible and outspoken magazine in the country. I don't believe any other publisher would dare publish a book of this type. So, no book, no article? Said Blomqvist. I think it sounds seriously good. Erickson said. There was a murmur of agreement from Cortez.
The article and the book are 2 different things, Berger said. For the magazine, Mikhail is the publisher and responsible for the content. With regard to the book publication, the author is responsible for the content.
I know, Svensson said. That doesn't bother me. The moment the book is published, Mia will file a police report against everyone I name. I'll stir up a hell of a fuss, Cortez said. That's only half the story, said Svensson. I've also been analysing some of the networks that make money off the sex trade. We're talking about organised crime. And who's involved? That's what's so tragic. The sex mafia is a sleazy bunch of nobodies. I don't really know what I expected when I started this research, but somehow we, at least I, had the idea that the mafia was a gang in the upper echelon of society. A number of American movies on the subject have probably contributed to that image. Your story about Venestrom, Svensson turned to Blomqvist, also showed that sometimes this is actually the case. But Venestrom was an exception, in a sense. What I've turned up is a gang of brutal and sadistic losers who can hardly read or write. They're total morons when it comes to organization and strategic thinking. There are connections to bikers and somewhat more organized groups,
but in general it's a bunch of assholes who run the sex business."
"This is all made clear in your article," Berger said. "We have laws and a police force and a judicial system that we finance with millions of kroner in taxes each year to deal with the sex trade, and they can't even nail a bunch of morons."
"It's a tremendous assault on human rights, and the girls involved are so far down society's ladder that they're of no interest to the legal system. They don't vote. They can hardly speak Swedish except for the vocabulary they need to set up a trick. Of all crimes involving the sex trade, 99.99% are not reported to the police, and those that are hardly ever lead to a charge. This has got to be the biggest iceberg of all in the Swedish criminal world. Imagine if bank robberies were handled with the same nonchalance. It's unthinkable. Unfortunately, I've come to the conclusion that this method of handling the problem would not survive for a single day if it weren't for the fact that the criminal justice system simply does not want to deal with it. Attacks on teenage girls from Tallinn and Riga are not a priority. A whore is a whore. It's part of the system."
"And everyone knows it," Nielsen said. "So what do you all think?" Berger said.
"I like it," Blomqvist said. "We'll be sticking our necks out with this story, and that was the whole point of starting Millennium in the first place."
"That's why I'm still working at the magazine. The publisher has to jump off a cliff every now and then," Nielsen said.
Everyone laughed, except Blomqvist.
"He was the only one crazy enough to take on the job of publisher," Berger said. "We're going to run this in May, and your book will come out at the same time."
"Is the book done?" Blomqvist said. "No. I have the whole outline, but only half the text. If you agree to publish the book and give me an advance, then I can work on it full time. Almost all the research is done. All that's left are some supplementary details, actually just checking stuff I already know, and confronting the Johns I'm going to hang out to dry.
We'll produce it just like the Wennerström book. It'll take a week to do the layout," Malm nodded, "and 2 weeks to print. We'll complete the confrontations in March and April and sum it all up in a final 15-page section. We'll have the manuscript ready by April 15th, so we'll have time to go over all the sources."
"How will we work things with a contract and so on?"
"I've drawn up a book contract once before, but I'll probably have to have a talk with our lawyer." Berger frowned. "But I propose a short-term contract from February to May. We don't pay over the odds."
"That's fine with me. I just need a basic salary."
"Otherwise the rule of thumb is 50-50 on the earnings from the book after the costs are paid. How does that sound?"
"That sounds damn good," Svensson said.
"Work assignments," Berger said. "Malin, I want you to plan the themed issue. It will be your primary responsibility starting next month. You'll work with Dag and edit the manuscript. Lotta, that means I want you here as temporary editorial assistant for the magazine from March through May. You'll have to go full-time, and Malin or Mikael will back you up as time permits."
Ericsson nodded.
"Mikael, I want you to be the editor of the book."
Berger looked at Svensson.
"Mikael doesn't let on, but he's actually one hell of a good editor and he knows research. He'll put each syllable of your book under the microscope. He's going to come down like a hawk on every detail. I'm flattered that you want us to publish your book, but we have special problems at Millennium. We have one or two enemies who want nothing more than for us to go under. If we stick out our necks to publish something like this, it has to be 100% accurate. We can't afford anything less."
"And I wouldn't want it any other way."
"Good. But can you put up with having somebody looking over your shoulder and criticizing you every which way all spring?"
Svensson grinned and looked at Blomqvist. "Bring it on."
"If it's going to be a themed issue, we'll need more articles. Mika, I want you to write about the finances of the sex trade. How much money are we talking about annually? Who makes the money from the sex trade and where does it go? Can we find evidence that some of the money ends up in government coffers? Monica, I want you to check out sexual attacks in general. Talk to the women's shelters and researchers and doctors and welfare people. You two plus Dag will write the supporting articles. Henry, I want an interview with Mia Johansson. Dag can't do it himself. Portrait. Who is she? What is she researching and what are her conclusions? Then I want you to go in and do case studies from police reports. Krista, pictures. I don't know how we're going to illustrate this. Think about it." "This is probably the simplest theme of all to illustrate. Artie, no problem."
"Let me add one thing," Svensson said. "There's a small minority on the police force who are doing a hell of a fine job. It might be an idea to interview some of them." "Have you got any names?" Cortez said. "Phone numbers too," Svensson said.
"Great," Berger said.
The theme of the May issue is the sex trade. The point we have to make is that trafficking is a crime against human rights, and that these criminals must be exposed and treated like war criminals or death squads or torturers anywhere in the world. Now let's get going.
Chapter 5. Wednesday, January 12th to Friday, January 14th. Eppelwiken felt unfamiliar, even foreign, when for the first time in 18 months Salander turned into the drive in her rented Nissan Micra. From the age of 15 she had come twice a year to the nursing home, where her mother had been since all the evil had happened. Her mother had spent 10 years at Eppelwiken, and it was where she finally died, at only 46, with one last annihilating cerebral hemorrhage. The last 14 years of Agneta Sophia Salander's life had been punctuated by small cerebral hemorrhages, which left her unable to take care of herself. Sometimes she had not even been able to recognize her daughter. Thinking about her mother always pitched Salander into a mood of helplessness and darkness, black as night. As a teenager, she had cherished the fantasy that her mother would get well, and that they would be able to form some sort of relationship. That was her heart thinking. Her head knew that it would never happen. Her mother had been short and thin, but nowhere near as anorexic-looking as Salander. In fact, her mother had been downright beautiful and had a lovely figure, just like Salander's sister, Camilla. Salander did not want to think about her sister. For Salander, it was an irony of fate that she and her sister were so dramatically dissimilar. They were twins. Born within 20 minutes of each other, Lisbeth was first. Camilla was beautiful. They were so different that it seemed grossly unlikely that they could have come from the same womb. If something hadn't gone wrong with her genetic code, Lisbeth would have been as radiantly beautiful as her sister, and probably as crazy. From the time they were little girls, Camilla had been outgoing, popular, and successful at school, while Lisbeth had been ungiving and introverted, rarely responding to the teacher's questions. Camilla's grades were very good. Lisbeth's never were. Already in elementary school, Camilla had distanced herself from her sister to the point that she would not even take the same route to school that Lisbeth took. Teachers and friends noticed that the two girls never had anything to do with each other, never sat next to each other. From the age of 8, they had been in separate classes. When they were 12 and all the evil happened, they had been sent to different foster homes. They had not seen each other since their 17th birthday, and that meeting had ended with Lisbeth getting a black eye and Camilla a fat lip. Lisbeth did not know where Camilla was living now, and she hadn't made any attempt to find out. In Lisbeth's eyes, Camilla was insincere, corrupt, and manipulative, but it was Lisbeth whom society had declared incompetent. She zipped up her leather jacket before she walked through the rain to the main entrance. She stopped at a garden bench and looked around. On this very spot, 18 months ago, she had seen her mother for the last time. She had paid an unscheduled visit to the nursing home when she was on her way north to help Blomqvist in his attempt to track down a serial killer. Her mother had been restless and didn't seem to recognize Salander. She held on tight to her hand and looked at her with a bewildered expression. Salander was in a hurry. She loosened her mother's grip, gave her a hug, and rode away on her motorcycle. The director of Eppelwiken, Agnes Mikkelsen, greeted her warmly and took her to a storeroom where they found the cardboard box. Salander hefted it. Only 5 or 6 pounds. Not much in the way of an inheritance.
"I had a feeling you'd come back some day," Mikkelsen said. "I've been out of the country," Salander said.
She thanked her for saving the box, carried it back to the car and left Eppelwiken for the last time. Salander was back in Musabaka just after noon. She put her mother's box unopened in a hall closet and left the apartment again. As she opened the front door, a police car drove slowly past. Salander warily observed the presence of the authorities outside her building, but when they showed no sign of interest in her, she put them out of her mind. She went shopping at H&M and Kappahl department stores and bought herself a new wardrobe. She picked up a large assortment of basic clothes in the form of pants, jeans, tops, and socks. She had no interest in expensive designer clothing,
but she did enjoy being able to buy half a dozen pairs of jeans at one time without a second thought. Her most extravagant purchases were from Twilfit, where she chose a drawerful of panties and bras. This was basic clothing again, but after half an hour of embarrassed searching, she also settled on a set that she thought was sexy, even erotic, and which she would never have dreamed of buying before. When she tried them on that night, she felt incredibly foolish. What she saw in the mirror was a thin, tattooed girl in grotesque underwear. She took them off and threw them in the trash. She also bought herself some winter shoes and two pairs of lighter indoor shoes. Then she bought a pair of black boots with high heels that made her a couple of inches taller. She also found a good winter jacket in brown suede. She made coffee and a sandwich before she drove the rental car back to its garage near Ringen. She walked home and sat in the dark all evening on her window seat, watching the water in Saltsjön. Mia Johansson cut the cheesecake and decorated each slice with a scoop of raspberry ice cream. She served Berger and Blomqvist first before she put down plates for Svensson and herself. Eriksson had resolutely resisted dessert and was content with black coffee in an old-fashioned flowered porcelain cup.
"It was my grandmother's china service," said Mia when she saw Eriksson examining the cup.
"She's scared to death that a cup is going to break," Svensson said. "She takes it out only when we have really important guests."
Johansson smiled.
"I spent several years with my grandmother when I was a child, and the china is almost all I have left of her."
"They're really beautiful," Eriksson said. "My kitchen is 100% IKEA."
Blomqvist didn't give a damn about flowered coffee cups and instead cast an appraising eye on the plate with the cheesecake. He pondered letting his belt out a notch. Berger apparently shared his feelings.
"Good God, I should have said no to dessert too," she said, glancing ruefully at Eriksson before taking up her spoon with a firm grip.
It was supposed to be a simple working dinner, in part to cement the cooperation they had agreed on and in part to continue to discuss plans for the themed issue. Svensson had suggested that they meet at his place for a bite to eat, and Johansson had served the best sweet and sour chicken Blomqvist had ever tasted. Over dinner they put away two bottles of robust Spanish red, and Svensson had asked if anyone would like a glass of Tullamore Dew with their dessert. Only Berger was foolish enough to decline, and Svensson got out the glasses. It was a one-bedroom apartment in Enskede. Svensson and Johansson had been going out for a few years, but had taken the plunge and moved in together a year ago. The group gathered around 6 p.m., and by the time dessert was served at 8:30, not a word had been said about the ostensible reason for the dinner. But Blomqvist did discover that he liked his hosts and enjoyed their company. It was Berger who finally steered the conversation to the topic they had all come to discuss. Johansson produced a printout of her thesis and placed it on the table in front of Berger. It had a surprisingly ironic title, From Russia with Love, an homage, of course, to Ian Fleming's classic novel. The subtitle was Trafficking, Organized Crime, and Society's Response.
"You have to recognize the difference between my thesis and the book Doug is writing," she said. "Doug's book is a polemic aimed at the people who are making money from trafficking. My thesis is statistics, field studies, law texts, and a study of how society and the courts treat the victims."
"The girls, you mean?"
"Young girls, usually 15 to 20 years old, working class, poorly educated. They often have unstable home lives, and many of them are subjected to some form of abuse, even in childhood. One reason they come to Sweden is that they have been fed a pack of lies."
"By the sex traders?"
"In this sense, there is a sort of gender perspective to my thesis. It's not often that a researcher can establish roles along gender lines so clearly. Girls, victims, boys, perpetrators. Apart from a handful of women working on their own who profit from the sex trade, there is no other form of criminality in which the sex roles themselves are a precondition for the crime. Nor is there any other form of criminality in which social acceptance is so great, or which society does so little to prevent. And yet Sweden does have tough laws against trafficking and the sex trade," Berger said. "Is that not the case?" "Don't make me laugh. Several hundred girls, there are no published statistics, obviously, are transported to Sweden every year to work as prostitutes, which in this case means making their bodies available for systematic rape. After the law against trafficking went into effect, it was tested in the courts a few times. The first time was in April 2003. the case against that crazy brothel madam who had a sex change. And she was acquitted, of course.
I thought she was convicted.
Of running a brothel, yes. But she was acquitted of trafficking charges. The thing was, the girls who were the victims were also the witnesses against her. And they vanished, back to the Baltics. Interpol tried to track them down, but after months of searching it was decided that they were not going to be found.
What had become of them?
Nothing. The TV show Insider did a follow-up and went over to Tallinn. It took the reporters exactly one afternoon to find two of the girls who were living with their parents. The third girl had moved to Italy.
The police in Tallinn, in other words, weren't very effective. Since then we have actually won a couple of convictions, but in each case there were men who had been arrested for other crimes, or who were so conspicuously stupid that they couldn't help but be caught. The law is pure window dressing. It isn't enforced. And the problem here, Svensson said, is that the crime is aggravated rape, often in conjunction with abuse, aggravated abuse and death threats, and in some instances illegal imprisonment as well. That's everyday life for many of the girls who were brought, wearing miniskirts and heavy makeup, to some villa in the suburbs. The thing is that a girl like that doesn't have any choice. Either she goes out and fucks dirty old men, or she risks being abused and tortured by her pimp. The girls can't run away. They don't know the language. They don't know the law, and they don't know where they could turn. They can't go home because their passports have been taken away. And in the case of the brothel madam, the girls were locked in an apartment.
It sounds like slave labour camps.
Do the girls make any money at all?
Oh, yeah, Johansson said. They usually work for several months before they're allowed to go back home. They're given between 20,000 and 30,000 kroner, which in Russian money is a small fortune. Unfortunately, they've often picked up heavy alcohol or drug habits, and a lifestyle that means the money will run out very quickly. This makes the system self-sustaining. After a while, they're back again, and return voluntarily, so to speak, to their torturers.
How much money is this business turning over annually? Blomqvist asked. Mia glanced at Svensson and thought for a moment before she responded.
It's very hard to give an accurate answer. We've calculated back and forth, but most of our figures are necessarily estimates.
Give us a broad brush.
Okay. We know, for example, that the madam, the one convicted of procuring but acquitted of trafficking, brought 35 women from the East over a 2-year period. They were all here for anything from a few weeks to several months. In the course of the trial, it emerged that over those 2 years they took in 2 million kroner. I've worked out that a girl can bring in an estimated 60,000 kroner a month. Of this, about 15,000, say, is costs. Travel, clothing, full board, etc. It's no life of luxury. They may have to crash with a bunch of other girls in some apartment the gang provides for them. Of the remaining 45,000 kroner, the gang takes between 20,000 and 30,000. The gang leader stuffs half into his own pocket, say 15,000, and divides the rest among his employees, drivers, muscle, others. The girl gets to keep 10,000 to 12,000 kroner.
And per month?
Suppose a gang has 2 or 3 girls grinding away for them, and they take in around 150,000 a month. A gang consists of 2 or 3 people, and that's their living. That's about how the finances of rape look.
And how many of them are we talking about, if you extrapolate?
At any given time, there are about 100 active girls who are in some way victims of trafficking. That means the total income in Sweden each month would be around 6 million kroner, around 70 million per year. And that's only the girls who are victims of trafficking.
That sounds like small change.
It is small change. And to bring in these relatively modest sums, around 100 girls have to be raped. It drives me mad.
That sounds like an objective researcher. But how many creeps are living off these girls?
I reckon about 300. That doesn't sound like an insurmountable problem, Berger said. We pass laws and the media gets outraged, but hardly anyone has actually talked to one of these girls from the East or has any idea how they live.
How does it work? I mean, in practice. It's probably fairly difficult to bring a 16-year-old over here from Tallinn without anyone noticing. How does it work once they arrive? Blomqvist asked.
When I started researching this, I thought we were talking about an incredibly well-run organization with some form of professional mafia, spiriting girls unnoticed across the borders.
But it's not, Ericsson said.
The business is organized, but I came to the conclusion that we're talking about many small and badly organized gangs. Forget the Armani suits and the sports cars. The average gang is half Russians or Balts and half Swedes. The gang leader is typically 40, has very little education, and has had problems all his life. His view of women is pure Stone Age.